Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Saturday, February 21st, and we have today's reading of the Boston Herald being read to you by Ken. Good morning, Ken.
Hello and welcome. And a big story on today's Mind, Nor'easter packing blizzard-like conditions. In addition to feeling like 2015 deja vu all over again, yet another strong nor'easter is expected to hit the region late on Sunday through Monday, as meteorologists warn about heavy snow and blizzard-like conditions in spots. Forecast models had initially shown the storm missing, but then the models on Friday shifted as they showed the system getting closer and closer to hitting the Bay State. The Cape and Islands are expected to get slammed the hardest, along with the South Coast and South Shore. More than a foot of snow will be possible in those southeastern parts of Massachusetts. Strong winds and coastal flooding are also expected. For Boston, the odds of 6-plus inches of snow was looking decent, according to National Weather Service meteorologist Bryce Williams. It's a real possibility, Williams said, of more than 6 inches of snow in the Boston area from Sunday night through Monday. AccuWeather prediction for the Boston area was 4 to 8 inches of snow and 12 inches of snow for the Cape and Islands. Winds will be in the 40 to 50 mile per hour range. There will be blizzard-like conditions out there, AccuWeather senior meteorologist Tom Kynes told the Herald. Around the city, it might not reach blizzard criteria, but there could be a time when it looks like a blizzard out there, with heavier snow and the winds howling, he added. The Monday morning commute will be a very slow go. Traveling is going to be poor at best. The snow is expected to start Sunday night, with the heaviest snow peaking Monday morning before tapering off later in the day. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm watch for the Cape Islands and South Coast. Whiteout conditions are possible at times and may make travel treacherous and potentially life-threatening, National Weather Service Boston wrote in its watch. Monitor the latest forecast for updates on this situation. If meteorologists continue to see the storm shifting northwest, If meteorologists continue to see the storm shifting northwest, the winter storm watch will need to be expanded to include more of eastern Massachusetts. In addition to the snow, there's increasing confidence in seeing widespread 50-plus mile-per-hour gusts on Cape Cod and the islands, according to NWS. Damaging winds could bring down trees and power lines, so power outages are possible. High wind watches have been issued for the Cape and Islands, with storm watches for the coastal waters. This will be a dangerous storm for mariners with the potential for at least 25-foot seas offshore. Strong winds can cause hazardous waves which could capsize or damage vessels and reduce visibility, NWS Boston wrote. Mariners should consider altering plans to avoid possible hazardous conditions. Remain in port, seek safe harbor, alter course, and or secure the vessel for severe wind and seas. Also, high astronomical tides Monday into Tuesday will bring the potential for minor to moderate coastal flooding along the eastern Mass coast, depending upon the timing of the highest surge. Surge models show a 3-foot surge around high tide early Monday morning and again early Tuesday morning, which could bring the water level to over 6 feet in Nantucket Harbor and up to 13.5 feet in Boston. And political winds, Joe Battenfeld's column, A Tale of Two Cities and Taxes. The reality of running a big city is hitting two mayors, Michelle Wu and socialist Zohran Mamdani, as they face businesses fleeing their cities while walloping taxpayers with huge tax hikes rather than cutting their ballooning budgets. Wu issued an ultimatum to Massachusetts lawmakers to approve her commercial tax hike or hit Boston property owners with a 13% hike. Her strategy failed miserably as lawmakers refused to give in to her demands. In New York, Mamdani issued a nearly identical ultimatum to state lawmakers to approve his proposal to hike taxes on the wealthy and corporations. He will hit residents with a 9.5% property tax increase if state lawmakers rebuff his demands. In New York, Mamdani issued a nearly identical ultimatum. He will hit residents with a 9.5% property tax increase if state lawmakers rebuff his demands. After years of fiscal mismanagement, we're staring at a $5.4 billion budget gap and two paths, the rookie New York City mayor posted on X. One, Albany can raise taxes on the ultra-wealthy and the most profitable corporations and address the fiscal imbalance between our city and state. The other, a last resort, balance the budget on the backs of working people using the only tools at the city's disposal. Mondani's demands don't seem to be moving lawmakers either. Bursting his socialist bubble, it means even more New York City residents and businesses will be fleeing the regime to avoid the huge tax hikes. But Mamdani and Wu blaming state lawmakers for their fiscal problems rather than compromise or changing their tactics. Wu has gone so far as to punish her opponents in the state Senate by running candidates against them. The end result is that both socialist icons will be passing on massive tax hikes to middle-class people they promised to help in their campaigns. Wu is also facing an alarming decline in commercial property values in downtown Boston, which is taking a huge toll on the $4.8 billion budget, which is financed through property taxes. But she stubbornly refuses to cut her budget to prevent the tax hikes, instead adding scores of diversity positions. Her budget has grown 26% over the last 4 years, from $3.8 billion to $4.8 billion. Mamdani is cutting about 5,000 officer positions in the New York City Police Department to pay for his expensive socialist and diversity programs. His $127 billion spending plan includes $5.6 million a year for the Office of Racial Equity and $4.6 million for the similarly named Commission on Racial Equality. He is also paying for a number of high-level diversity and inclusion positions throughout his administration and $835,000 a year for the Commission on Gender Equity. Wu, in contrast with Mamdani, has not gone so far as to whack her police department budget. But like Mamdani, her tax hikes and anti-business policies are causing hundreds of businesses to cut jobs or move out of the city entirely, and the number of children living in the city has dropped precipitously by about 10,000 in the last 15 years. In New York City, thousands of jobs are leaving to states like Texas with low taxes and more business-friendly policies. Mamdani has proposed increasing New York City's corporate tax rate from 7.25% to a whopping 11.5%, and that is likely to worsen the exodus. In the Boston Public Schools, a city hoop player forced to sit scores hearing. The Boston City Council is set to hold a hearing Monday on a BPS student athletic transfer order that appears to have been sparked by viral social media posts around a senior who has been barred from playing basketball since switching high schools. The hearing comes amid criticism around a situation involving Amir Muhammad, a Boston Public School student who, per social media posts and counselors, has been prevented from playing basketball this year after transferring from Madison Park Technical Vocational High School to Charlestown High School. Counselor Gabriel Cortala Zapata, who represents East Boston and Charlestown, put forward the hearing order regarding Boston Public Schools student-athlete transfer and eligibility policies at a January 28th City Council meeting. Student athletes transfer schools for many valid non-athletic reasons, academic needs, special education support, health concerns, or family circumstances, Coletta Zapata said. Yet, too often, those transfers trigger eligibility reviews that are confusing, opaque, and unforgiving, where missed deadlines, miscommunication, or adult decision-making can cost a child an entire season. We've heard concerns from one of my neighborhoods about inconsistent standards, limited notice, unclear appeals, and review processes that don't always guarantee students a meaningful opportunity to be heard. When systems lack transparency and due process, students, not institutions, end up paying the price, Coletta Zapata added. Coletta Zapata did not directly address the student-athlete who appeared to drive her hearing order, but Counselor-at-Large Erin Murphy indicated that it applies to the Mohammed eligibility scandal that's gained significant traction on social media. For many, a sport is what gets our kids to school, so I think this hearing is important, Murphy said last month. Unfortunately, in this case, the student that I'm aware of, and I'm not sure if it's the same one, probably will not be able to play basketball this term. I'm hoping that our advocacy can make sure this never happens again. Murphy told the Herald she was referring to Mohammed in her remarks and elaborated on her position on Friday. What makes situations like this so concerning is not simply that a student was ruled ineligible, Murphy said in a statement. It is whether the rules are being applied consistently and transparently. The Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association sets transfer standards, but those standards must be enforced uniformly. Coaches and administrators cannot pick and choose when to follow them, Murphy added. When a student transfers for documented special education needs, fairness and student well-being must remain at the center. The Boston Public Schools did not respond to a Herald inquiry Friday about why Mohammed hasn't been allowed to play basketball this year. Mayor extends fare-free MBTA bus pilot. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu said the city will spend another $1 million in federal funds to extend a fare-free MBTA bus pilot for 3 more months. Wu said yesterday that the city will use its remaining American Rescue Plan Act dollars at a rate of $340,000 per month to extend the fare-free pilot program for MBTA bus routes 23, 28, and 29 through the end of June. Based on that monthly reimbursement rate to the MBTA, the program has cost the city about $17.34 million in ARPA funds to waive fares for riders on bus routes that serve Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury since it was launched in March 2022. Initially envisioned as a 2-year pilot, the Wu administration extended the program for 2 years in February 2024, and now for another 3 months ahead of its anticipated expiration at the end of this month. The city of Boston is in talks with the MBTA about how to keep the fare-free bus program in place for the long term, the mayor's office said. Fare-free bus service helps families, workers, and businesses, and also makes bus service faster and more reliable, Wu said in a statement. We are extending this program through June as we look to work with the MBTA to keep this going. The mayor's office said ridership increased by 35% on the 3 fare-free routes in the first year of the pilot, which is more than twice the MBTA average. The targeted routes have seen a 16% spike in ridership since before the pandemic. Surveys conducted by the city have shown more than a quarter of riders using those routes have saved at least $20 a month, which they have reported putting towards other household expenses like groceries, medicine, rent, or school supplies, the mayor's office said. Other survey respondents reported that the fare-free bus transportation has helped them build emergency funds, cover school expenses, or simply stay in their homes, the mayor's office said. Interim Transportation Secretary and MBTA General Manager Philip Eng said Friday that the T has been pleased to be able to support the city fare-free bus pilot program, but gave no indication of whether it would be extended beyond June. Penn in Duxbury, mom seeks two-stage trial, innocent or guilty, postpartum psychosis. Lindsay Clark wants her trial for the strangulation murder of her three children split into two parts, one to decide whether she is guilty and a second to determine if she was legally insane. Clancy, 35, is charged with murdering her three children, 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Kaylin, by strangling them with exercise bands in the basement of the family home on Summer Street in Duxbury the night of January 24, 2023. Her attorney, Kevin Reddington, argued in Plymouth Superior Court yesterday for her trial to be split into two parts, a legal maneuver known as bifurcation. The first, determine whether she was guilty of murdering her children, and then to determine whether she was legally responsible due to suffering postpartum psychosis. The hearing was the first time that Clancy had been physically present in a courtroom for the entire case. Authorities say she leapt from a second-floor bedroom window of the home after killing her children, rendering her paraplegic. She has previously attended hearings through video teleconferencing from her bed at Tewksbury Hospital, where she has been committed since October 2023. Reddington said that he commended the Sheriff's Department, his staff, and Tewksbury medical staff, who melded together incredibly and have done just a marvelous job of caring for and transporting Clancy to the court. He also said he wants his client to appear in person moving forward if possible. Clancy, wearing all black and a silver cross on a necklace, was wheeled in by court officers for her hearing before Judge William Sullivan. She remained silent and primarily stared ahead throughout the proceedings, other than to exchange a good afternoon with the judge. The hearing was not a long one and primarily consisted of setting dates for future hearings ahead of her murder trial, scheduled for July. After going back and forth over conflicting schedules, the parties arrived at March 2nd for oral arguments on outstanding issues, including for the bifurcated trial, and April 10th for a mental evaluation to be conducted by an expert chosen by the prosecutors. Then, finally, June 18th for a further motions hearing. Of interest regarding the testing is that prosecutor Jennifer Sprague said that she has no problem with videotaping the evaluation, but would object to taping Clancy filling out forms due to the proprietary rights of the company providing the test. I would suggest that we file that under W for who cares. We're not here to protect proprietary rights of private businesses and enterprises, Reddington said, but added that he isn't really sure if videoing that process is important or not, and would like to counter with his own experts for guidance before arguing over the issue. Reddington confirmed early on in the case that he will be pursuing an insanity defense for his client. Reddington has maintained that his client, Clancy, was emotionally unstable at the time of her children's deaths. Clancy had, at the time, been suffering from postpartum depression. Reddington has said in court documents say that Clancy, who was a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital, was taking medications including antidepressants, anxiety-targeting benzodiazepine drugs, and the antipsychotic drug Seroquel, at least as far back as the September before the deaths. Clancy's husband, Patrick Clancy, has previously said that he wasn't married to a monster and last month filed a wrongful death suit against two of Lindsay Clancy's health care providers, claiming that they over and inappropriately medicated her in the months before the children were killed. He named Dr. Jennifer Tufts and nurse practitioner Rebecca Gelada, who both prescribed Lindsay several medications along with their respective practices, Aster Mental Health Incorporated and South Shore Health, as defendants. South Shore Health cares deeply about and prioritizes the safety of our patients and their families and always strives to provide excellent care, the practice said in a statement to the Herald. Given that this matter is now in litigation, we cannot comment on specific allegations contained in the lawsuit. And up at the State House, DGA names new commissioner. Comes amid SNAP fraud cases. Acting Department of Transitional Assistance, DTA, Director Michael Cole has been appointed as the agency's official head, effective immediately, as a flurry of SNAP EBT fraud schemes have been uncovered in Massachusetts, and just days after the Herald published a DTA whistleblower's account of rampant fraud within the program. I am pleased to share with you that Michael Cole has been appointed Commissioner of DTA, effective immediately. As you know, Michael has served as acting commissioner since September 2025, after more than a decade of service to DTA in other roles, said Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Kiame Mahaina on Thursday in an agency-wide email obtained by the Herald. We are grateful for his continued leadership and know that his incredible depth of knowledge of the agency and compassion for the people we serve will position DTA well to meet that critical moment in our shared work. Please join me in thanking Michael for his continued service to DTA, he said. Cole's appointment comes just days after the Herald detailed a whistleblower's account of rampant fraud in the state's SNAP EBT program and lackluster efforts to combat the fraud in the DTA. It also follows multiple SNAP and other public benefits fraud busts by the U.S. Attorney's Office and the State Auditor's Office. Cole has served as acting commissioner of the DTA since September 2025, following the retirement of former commissioner Jeff McHugh. In the press release announcing Cole's appointment, the DTA credited him with guiding the agency through the recent suspension of the SNAP program during the federal government shutdown and for leading the DTA through federal changes to the program under President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill. DTA is going through a critical time, fulfilling the agency's extremely important role as our state's top defense against food insecurity while adapting to major federal pressures, said Secretary Mahaina in a public statement. Michael's incredible depth of knowledge of the agency and ability to manage its operational needs, plus his strong relationships with DTA's partners and deep compassion for the people we serve, make him the right leader of DTA to meet this moment. In December, the feds busted an alleged $7 million SNAP fraud scheme run by two Haitian men. In January, the U.S. Attorney's Office announced another SNAP fraud bust, a $1 million scheme allegedly run by a naturalized U.S. citizen from the Dominican Republic, two illegal immigrants, and one green card holder. Meanwhile, the State Auditor's Bureau of Special Investigations, BSI, has identified over $34 million in public benefits fraud in fiscal year 23, 24, and 25, with SNAP representing the largest share of fraud in each year. BSI also reported that 82.9% of all referrals processed by the office in FY24 involved SNAP, while 78% of referrals processed in FY25 involved SNAP. The BSI has also found that in FY23, 24, and 25, a significant share of the detected fraud was tied to DTA programs. In FY23, a whopping 69% of identified fraud was tied to DTA programs, totaling $8.49 million. The figure dropped, but was still high in FY24, with DTA programs tied to 59% of identified fraud, good for $6.02 million. In FY25, identified fraud tied to DTA programs dropped again, yet still remained high, making up 49% or $4.95 million. The state Senate's Republican caucus is calling for an oversight hearing on SNAP EBT fraud in Massachusetts after the Herald reported the account of a whistleblower in the Department of Transitional Assistance, DTA, and the rampant fraud within the SNAP EBT program and the DTA's lackluster efforts in stopping it. This all as Governor Maura Healey continues to refuse to turn over information on Massachusetts SNAP recipients, including immigration status, to the Trump administration and the USDA to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. Healey says that Trump has not provided her office any assurances that the information will not be handed over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. I am grateful for this opportunity to build on the foundation laid by former Commissioner McHugh and lead DTA through this particularly challenging time for DTA, said Cole. We have a lot of work to do in implementing recent federal changes, but DTA staff at every level are the most skilled, compassionate, and innovative colleagues anyone could ask for. I am confident that in this national moment, DTA will personify excellence in public service and deliver proudly for the many people in Massachusetts who rely on us. The DTA's press release also featured statements in support of Cole and the troubled agency from several state lawmakers and leaders of nonprofit organizations. All of these additional statements included clear criticism of the federal government and recent changes to the SNAP program under the Trump administration, while failing to mention the recent fraud uncovered in Massachusetts. Healey's office and the DTA declined to comment on whether Cole's appointment is related to the recently uncovered SNAP fraud schemes and the Herald's whistleblower report. Civil rights claim planned in fatal crash involving state police sergeant. Attorney says Sergeant Scott Quigley's alleged intoxication information delays point to a farce of investigation and possible cover-up. Woburn. The family of a special needs man who died after a December 2023 crash caused by state police sergeant Scott Quigley is preparing to expand their wrongful death lawsuit to include civil rights violations. Attorney Mike Mahoney, who represents Lynn Schettino, the mother of 37-year-old Angelo Schettino, said state police supervisors not only withheld information about the head-on crash in Woburn, in which Quigley was allegedly driving nearly twice the speed limit and under the influence, but also misled the family about the status of the investigation. A report from the Disabled Persons Protection Commission states that Angelo Schettino, a paraplegic man formerly from Saugus, was riding in a van on his way home from a medical appointment when the head-on crash occurred. According to the document, Schettino suffered internal injuries and developed sepsis. Given the extent of his injuries and his prognosis, the report states that the decision was made to pursue comfort-focused care. He was removed from life support on January 11, 2024. He died on January 13, 2024, about a month after the crash. The initial lawsuit states that before his death, Angelo Schettino experienced great pain of body and anguish in mind, resulting in conscious pain and suffering prior to his death. Delays missing investigative steps. Mahoney said that when attorneys sought information about the wreck, state police supervisors told them the investigation was still active, only to discover once the documents were released that the last notation in the file had been made 6 months earlier and that Quigley's medical records had not been reviewed. According to Mahoney, the crash report stated that Quigley was found to be only partially at fault and labeled the incident a medical situation without specifying what that medical issue was. In a motion to compel discovery, attorneys pointed out that Quigley himself reported having no memory of the crash, saying, "It appears I may have fallen asleep at the wheel, and that immediately prior, he felt extremely fatigued and lightheaded. As the case has progressed, however, hospital records have come to light that suggest Quigley's blood alcohol content was 0.11, above the legal limit of 0.8. It seems they were just delaying the release of the crash information, Mahoney said. Mahoney said it took 13 months before attorneys received any meaningful records from the state police, which he described as an unusually long delay given the severity of the crash and the fact that the death was involved. He also pointed out that the state police never conducted an accident reconstruction, a standard step in serious injury collisions, and State Police Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, the crash investigator, did not interview Quigley until 8 days after the crash. We know now there wasn't an investigation. It was a farce, Mahoney said. When asked whether he believes the omission amounted to a cover-up, Mahoney said, "It's looking like that, yeah. It's walking like a duck, yeah, for sure," he added. Fight over medical records. Mahoney said that that because the state police were delaying the release of the crash information, the initial lawsuit was filed against Bridgewell Incorporated, the Peabody-based nonprofit whose wheelchair-accessible van Angelo Shantino was riding in when the crash occurred. In a third-party complaint, Bridgewell argued that its driver was operating properly at about 5 p.m. December 12, 2023, when Quigley's cruiser suddenly drove from its lane of traffic across the double yellow line into the Bridgewell driver's lane of traffic and caused a collision. In addition to Angelo Shantino's death, the van's driver was hospitalized. Quigley also suffered serious injuries and was taken to Lehi Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington, according to court records. He sustained trauma to his liver and kidney, an open abdominal wound, and a fractured left hip socket. He was released from Lehi Hospital on December 16, 2023. Bridgewell subpoenaed Quigley's medical records from Lehi Hospital. The hospital initially produced the records with toxicology results redacted, prompting Bridgewell to file a second motion to compel the unredacted records. The attorney opposed Bridgewell's request, arguing the toxicology results were irrelevant to the civil case and should remain private. The filing stated that his laboratory results will shed no further light on liability or damages, and that releasing them would result in an invasion of the non-party's privacy for no legitimate purpose. The opposition also acknowledged that liability for the crash was not in dispute, stating, "There is no reasonable view of the facts in which the Massachusetts State Police will not be liable for the plaintiff's damages, as they owned and were responsible for the operation of the vehicle." On January 20th, however, an Essex Superior Court judge ordered the complete, unredacted toxicology results to be turned over. Revelations surfaced during murder retrial. The bombshell revelations about Quigley's crash were brought to the surface because of the retrial of the Fan brothers in a 2020 Lowell murder. Quigley had been a key investigator in that case, in which brothers Billy Fan, Palomi Balokum Fan, and Chana Fan are accused of gunning down 22-year-old Tyrone Fett outside his Lowell home on September 14, 2020. The Fan brothers defense team, composed of attorneys William Dolan, Lorenzo Perez, and Mark Wester, sought discovery from the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, which ultimately led them to disclose the crash-related information. The state police subsequently suspended Quigley without pay. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office, where Quigley worked as a homicide investigator, then referred the matter to the Suffolk County District Attorney for review of possible criminal charges. The defense attorneys have since sought for the first-degree murder charges pending against the Fan brothers to be dismissed, arguing that the circumstances surrounding Quigley's crash call into question the integrity of his investigative work. In the meantime, the defense attorneys filed a motion requesting an evidentiary hearing to determine whether the state police withheld information or engaged in misconduct that would undermine the prosecution's case. The filing, submitted in Middlesex Superior Court, asked to subpoena 19 current and former law enforcement officers, including Quigley and Penton, to testify under oath about how the Woburn crash was handled. Prosecutors initially had until Friday to respond to the defense's motion, but Dolan, representing China Fan, said shortly after 5 p.m. that Judge Chris Barry Smith had granted more time for them to file their response. "My client is frustrated because we are asking for bail after that hearing," Dolan said. "This is just more of the same dragging their feet." Longing for peace. Mahoney said the lawsuit, as it currently stands, falls under the Massachusetts Tort Claims Act, which caps damages against public employees acting within the scope of their duties at $100,000. "What's Angelo's life worth?" Mahoney said. "It's certainly more than $100,000. With the toxicology report suggesting Quigley's blood alcohol content at 0.11, Mahoney said it raises critical questions, such as, where was he drinking, and was he drinking on the job? He said that if Quigley was acting outside the scope of his duties at the time of his crash, and if other officers impeded or mishandled the investigation, it could amount to a violation of Angelo Centino's civil rights. That, he said, is why he plans to expand the lawsuit to include a civil rights claim. In politics, by Peter Lucas, life is short, history is long. California Governor Gavin Newsom is right. Donald Trump is only temporary. But so aren't we all, when you think about it. Life is short. History is long. Gavin, a 2028 Democrat Party presidential hopeful, made his remarks about Trump at the annual Munich Security Conference last week. No, it is not a conference where insecure politicians go for therapy. The conference these days is where potential presidential candidates go to check the box on their foreign affairs knowledge and policy chops. That considered, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, 35, also considered to be a presidential candidate, peaked too soon. In fact, she imploded at the conference when on foreign policy she failed to accurately locate Venezuela on the map. It's above the equator, and totally bungled a simple question about Taiwan. Her lightweight, mixed salad responses echoed Kamala Harris. Her cringeworthy appearance gave the lie to the old saying that 90% of success is just showing up. AOC showed up and was shot down. It was so bad that one wonders just what she learned at Boston University, where the 2011 graduate majored in international relations. Newsom, before the same worldwide audience, once again used his appearance to attack Trump, even to the point of calling Trump stupid. This came during a panel discussion on climate change and Trump's climate policy. "Donald Trump is doubling down on stupid," Newsom said. Earlier, Newsom, 58, said Donald Trump is temporary. He will be gone in 3 years, which is true, but Newsom is also temporary and will also be gone only a bit sooner. That is because he will shortly be an ex-governor when his term expires at the end of this year, and Trump will still be president. California has term limits for governor, and Newsom's term is up. And while Newsom, out of office in 2027, will continue bashing Trump, who will still be in office, the real Republican candidates for president in 2028, Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, will be under the radar, getting a free ride. Should Newsom be the Democrat nominee for president, he would be running against one of the two, or both, and not Trump. Newsom, who is a better Hollywood actor than a California governor, also apologized to the conference for failing to bring his acting props with him for his presentation. These are red knee pads that he brought with him to the earlier World Economic Forum in Davos. He said they were for international business leaders who were selling out and rolling over for Trump. He is selling knee pads on his website. Newsom, like a trained actor, liked the line so much that he used it again in Munich, this time chiding world leaders for not standing up to Trump, but kneeling before him over Greenland and tariffs. "It's embarrassing. I can't take the complicity," he said. "I should have brought a bunch of knee pads for all the world leaders." What is embarrassing is that Newsom, seeking to become a leader of the most powerful nation in the world, is traveling around Europe talking about knee pads. Not only that, but he also criticized European heads of state for bowing, scraping, and kneeling so low to Trump that they need knee pads. How statesmanlike is that? If Newsom were trying out for the lead role in a television movie about a candidate running for president, he might get it. But in real life, and the presidency, it is a part much too big for Governor Knee Pads. Over in Brookline, ex-youth swim coach jailed for child pornography. A Boston federal judge sentenced a former Brookline Town swim coach to 15 years in federal prison for coercing children into producing child pornography for him. I'm doing this because I need the money. This is making my anxiety worse, but I need the money. I just don't want to meet up. The thought makes me uncomfortable, but I need to get the phone and for the money. A 15-year-old Connecticut girl texted the child predator following his continuous pressure for more extreme and degrading content from her, according to a law enforcement affidavit filed in the case. Scott Cuna, 26, of Brookline, was arrested and charged with a single count of sexual exploitation of children in late January 2025. He pleaded guilty on October 5th, 2025. On Thursday, U.S. District Court Judge Myung J. Jun sentenced him to 15 years in federal prison to be followed by 5 years of supervised release, which is the sentence prosecutors and defense both recommended. Cuna was employed as a lifeguard instructor and swim coach at Brookline's Evelyn Kirani Aquatic Center from September 3, 2019 until July 22, 2022, a town spokeswoman told the Herald. None of the victims indicated in court documents were local. While Tuna's guilty plea was for exploitation of the victim quoted above, court records and prosecutors say that this was not a one-time offense, but one that affected multiple minors. Unfortunately, Minor 1 was not the only child that Cuna victimized. Cuna exploited other 14 to 16-year-old girls, including minors 2 and 5, persuading them to engage in sexually explicit conduct on camera and to send him the images via Snapchat, federal prosecutor Tracy Cummings wrote in a sentencing memorandum. The FBI investigation indicates that Cuna was corresponded with underage victims in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, Indiana, Michigan, Missouri, and Alabama. And his communication with them was aggressive, according to prosecutors, who say that the victims told him that his exploitation was harming their mental and emotional health. Cuna called his minor victims sluts and reprimanded them when they did not comply with his demands or did not send photos when he wanted them, Cummings wrote. He also ordered his minor victims to sexually degrade themselves for him in videos. Finally, Kuna pressured girls to meet up with him IRL, meaning in real life, which, according to prosecutors, actually happened at least once when Cummings wrote, he convinced a 13-year-old girl, minor number 3, to meet him at the mall. During that meeting, he attempted to touch and kiss the 13-year-old. Police search former Prince Andrew's home. London. Police searched the former home of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor again on Friday, a day after he was arrested and held in custody for nearly 11 hours on suspicion of misconduct in having shared confidential trade information with the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In another blow for the former Prince Andrew, the British government is considering formally removing him from the line of succession to the crown. Despite losing his status as prince and facing a police investigation, Andrew remains 8th in line to the throne. That can only be changed with new legislation. When the king stripped his brother of his titles in the fall, the government said passing a new law would not be a good use of Parliament's time. But that view has changed, and the government is now considering legislation once the police investigation is finished. James Murray, the government's chief secretary to the Treasury, said the government is considering any further steps that might be required, and we're not ruling anything out. The last time a royal was removed from the line of succession was after the abdication of King Edward VIII, in 1936, when the law was changed to strike him and any descendants from the list. Removing Andrew would also require agreement from more than a dozen other countries, including Jamaica, Canada, and Australia, that have the British monarch as head of state. Following one of the most tumultuous days in the modern history of Britain's royal family, the former prince was back at his new residence on the Sandringham Estate, King Charles III's private retreat, around 115 miles northeast of London. Police have concluded their search there, but are still searching Royal Lodge, his 30-room former home in the Parkland near Windsor Castle, just west of the capital, where the king's younger brother had lived for decades, until his eviction earlier this month. Unmarked vans believed to be police vehicles have been entering the grounds Friday morning. The search is expected to continue for several days. Mountbatten Windsor, who was pictured slouching in the back of his chauffeur-driven car following his release Thursday evening from a police station near Sandringham, remains under investigation, which means he has neither been charged nor exonerated by Thames Valley Police, the force responsible for areas west of London. Arrest was years in the making. His arrest follows years of allegations over his links with Epstein, who died by suicide in a New York jail in 2019. The accusation at the heart of his arrest is that Mountbatten Windsor, who was known as Prince Andrew until October when his brother stripped him of his title and honors and banished him from the Royal Lodge, shared confidential trade information with a disgraced financier when he was a trade envoy for the UK. Emails released last month by the US Department of Justice appeared to show Mountbatten Windsor sharing reports of official visits to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and Singapore, and sending Epstein a confidential brief on investment opportunities in Afghanistan. Thames Valley Police had previously said it was also reviewing allegations that a woman was trafficked to the UK by Epstein to have a sexual encounter with Andrew. Thursday's arrest had nothing to do with that. Other police forces are also conducting their own investigations into Epstein's links to the UK, including the assessment of flight logs at airports, large and small. They are coordinating their work within a national group. On Friday, London's Metropolitan Police said it was assessing, with the help of U.S. counterparts, whether the capital's airports, which include Heathrow, may have been used to facilitate human trafficking and sexual exploitation. It also said that it's asking past and present officers who protected Mountbatten Windsor to consider carefully whether they saw or heard anything that may be relevant to the investigation. As of now, it said no new criminal allegations have been made regarding sexual offenses within its jurisdiction. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing in his association with Epstein, but has not commented on the most recent allegations that have emerged with the release of the so-called Epstein files. Arrest was sudden. Investigation will take time. Police swept into the grounds of Mountbatten Windsor's home to arrest him at 8 a.m. Thursday, his 66th birthday, before taking him to Isham Police Station for questioning. It's not known what he told them. He may have said nothing or no comment, as is his right. Experts said that misconduct in a public office is notoriously difficult to prove. Firstly, it must be determined if Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was in a role within government that constitutes the title of public officer, said Sean Caulfield, a criminal defense lawyer at Hodge, Jones & Allen. There is no standard definition to clearly draw on. The Crown Prosecution Service will ultimately make a decision about charging Mountbatten Windsor. Andrew Gilmore, a partner at Grosvenor Law, said that prosecutors will apply the two-stage test known as the Code for Crown Prosecutors. That test is to determine whether there is a more realistic prospect of a conviction than not, based on the evidence, and whether the matter is in the public interest, he said. If these two tests are met, then the matter will be charged and proceed to court. Arrest is not just unusual, it's historic. Mountbatten Windsor was the first royal since King Charles I, nearly four centuries ago, to be placed under arrest. That turned into a seismic moment in British history, leading Charles' beheading and the temporary abolition of the monarchy. Mountbatten Windsor's arrest is arguably one of the gravest crises for the House of Windsor since the establishment more than 100 years ago. Arguably, only the abdication of King Edward VIII in 1936 and the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, in 1997 have been as grave for the institution of the British monarchy in modern times. In a statement Thursday, the King said the law must take its course, but that as this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter. The allegations are not related to Epstein's sex trafficking. The allegations being investigated Thursday are separate from those made by Virginia Goofy, who claims she was trafficked to Britain to have sex with the prince in 2001 when she was just 17. Goofy died by suicide last year. Still, Goofy's sister-in-law, Amanda Roberts, said that she was overjoyed when she got a phone call at 3 a.m. telling her the news of this arrest. But those feelings of elation were quickly complicated by the realization that she couldn't share the feelings of vindictiveness and vindication with Goofy. In the health department, what is ALS, the disease that killed actor Eric Dane? There's no cure for what is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Eric Dane, known for his roles on Grey's Anatomy and Euphoria, died this week from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis at age 53. The fatal nervous system disease, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, killed Dane less than a year after he announced his diagnosis. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, ALS is rare. In 2022, there were nearly 33,000 estimated cases, say researchers, who project that cases will rise to more than 36,000 by 2030. The disease is slightly more common in men than in women and tends to strike in midlife between the ages of 40 and 60. And that's it for today's reading of the Boston Herald. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.